All know is that there's really no way to cover indie media. You can't cover how much different forms of media we made, that it was digital, that it was social, that it was all these different things. It's like impossible to cover what was indie media. But we're really lucky to have this group of people to talk with us about their experiences of what indie media meant in their lives. I've asked them to cover very specific topics, so I'm sure they too could go on and on of many different aspects of what indie media was in their lives. We're going to cover, they know what they're going to cover. You're going to hear from them. So please welcome Daniel Chenworth and Evan Henshaw-Plath and Anna Noguera. And obviously this is a very discussion-oriented group. We had a very good and lively discussion this morning. And they are going to make presentations, but then there's definitely time for discussion afterwards. Not really Q&A, but like discussion, because we're all a lot of insiders here, a lot of shared experience. So, welcome. Welcome to you. Welcome to you.
So I'm going to get it started. My name is Anna. I'm from New York City. I was involved in building the New York City IMC and the Independent. And worked with Democracy Now! And other media groups along the way. And it seems weird to kind of answer the question, what was indie media to a group for people who were indie media? But I do think it's worth kind of reflecting and remembering just how wild and crazy and unscripted of an experiment this was that we all participated in. The first Seattle IMC was organized on a shoestring budget. Dee Dee was just showing me the budget. And no one really knew what was going to come out of these protests, and definitely no one expected, even the folks who built the Independent Media Center there to cover the WTO protests, they did not think or know or predict that a year later there'd be 175 Independent Media Centers serving so many different communities around the world. No one really expected that. So I think it's interesting to think back to that, like, how did we do that? This network just flourished online with new tools that had come into our hands that Evan is going to talk about later, lovingly known as Ravel. You might know him that way. We came out of protests like the WTO, and for me personally, it was A16 in DC, saying we can't just have these for protests. We need this every day in every community. And I went back home, and so many of you all went back home and built institutions, many of which still exist today. They might not be called independent media centers, although many are, but projects like the Independent that John, sitting right here, has stewarded for the last 19 years and still serves the left community in New York City and beyond. I mean, there's so many projects, and I'd like to hear more about what those are that exist today and came out of indie media. So again, just like thinking back, we were running while walking. You know, we were going to all these protests that were happening all the time in different places around the world, building community media centers on the fly with very little resources, pretty much no money. And at the same time, imagining trying to conceive and build a network of networks. And in much the same way that the global justice movement itself organized, we organized in spokes councils, and we created these listservs and IRC chat rooms where different people who'd never even met each other connected and started to dream about an alternative media network. So dealing in 35 different languages and coming up with processes and imagining a non-hierarchical, anti-capitalist, unfunded network of networks. That was quite a tall order, and yet we did it. So, hallelujah, congratulations to all of us. And I'd like the conversation to go, Danielle's going to talk about what it was like to build such a successful indie media center that's still going strong today, that supported so many other media projects. We're going to hear about the nitty-gritty of that. We can talk about, we can take questions and discussions about what were some of the downfalls of indie media. If we were to do some of this today, what would that be? What would that look like? One of them I hear all the time is, you know, the consensus-based model was really the demise of indie media. And that's fair, but I also argue that there was no other way to do that. You know, we, again, were like on the fly, working with people we didn't know, trying to build an alternative to this dominant hierarchical, we know best, we have all the resources, we tell you what to do model. That was not gonna fly. We had opportunities to get some funding from Ford Foundation, for example, and like, again, working online with people from a spokes council model for people all over the world. There were folks, for example, in Argentina who said, Ford Foundation directly it was complicit in the torture of workers, you know, back in the day, and there's no way we would have any credibility in our community if we were part of a network that accepted that money. And we had to choose, do we want this money or do we want Argentina IMC to be part of this network? And we chose Argentina IMC. So we were faced with a lot of those kinds of difficult decisions, and yes, it did slow us down, it did hinder us in many ways, and it did allow, you know, Facebook types to flourish more than indie media did, maybe, but again, it was a crazy wild experiment, and I think it was worthwhile nonetheless, and yeah, maybe I'll just leave it there and then leave more room for a discussion later, but just imagining just how wild and crazy we were, and there are lots of movements right now that are using, are experimenting, and how do we support them? How do we imagine in new ways? How do we allow them to imagine in ways that we never did, while also sharing what we've learned, I think is a challenge for us and something I'd like for us to talk about.
Yeah, so the way we got from one indie media center and indie media center for a single protest to the sort of global network is we gave people a model of something to copy. Like, we gave them, like, so you want to make media for a protest or you want to engage or change your relationship to the media, what we did was we said, okay, well, you can do these things, and if you do these things, it gives you an idea of what to do. The interesting thing is, looking back at it, I don't think the organizing that went into the Seattle WTO protest and the Independent Media Center there leading up to it was necessarily the thing that we ended up replicating all over the place. So for example, on the tech side, initially there wasn't a plan to use free software, and the initial plan was to use some some application that was created on a Microsoft Windows platform that was gonna do publishing and didn't have a sort of open publishing itself. There was gonna be, it had a vetting process by which someone would decide every single article that went on. And then about less than a week before the protest, it became clear that that software wasn't gonna be ready and wasn't gonna work. And so people started sort of asking around, and there was this Australian tech project called Active that had built sort of sites for local community organizing. So there was a calendar and a directory of organizations and a newswire that you could do open publishing on. And so at the very last week, this free software thing got adapted and sort of adopted and used for the indie media thing. And with that came all of the ideology and worldview and practices of the free software hacker community, which hadn't been tightly integrated with the media activist community. And so much so that when Deep Dish and Free Speech TV and all the other groups that had come together to form the Independent Media Center, those folks weren't very aware of what free software was. They weren't very aware of the practices or the culture around it or the way of licensing or the way of working. And so what happened is we kind of merged these two things together, and then we got that we should use IRC and that we should use these tools and we should use practices and Linux and all those other things like that. And so that, to me, one of the things that was really interesting about indie media and unique is that we had this sort of cultural merging of different practices of this long-standing independent alternative media culture that had existed as activist media and this technology culture which said that we should adapt and sort of sort of adopt this sort of free software community's way of organizing. And the two of those together, along with this idea that this is something we should replicate. That, you know, I remember the phone call where we said, oh, well, we'll move all of indiemedia.org to seattle.indiemedia.org, and we'll make the new www.indiemedia.org site point to whatever the current protest is. And once it was done, we would archive it at whatever place.indiemedia.org. And I think we did that for Boston for the biodevastation protest. And after that, we're like, oh, we're breaking all the links and this is a terrible idea. But it was sort of this sort of like, how do you adapt it? How do you give enough structure? And once we did that, then people saw something that they could replicate. It was kind of this sort of crazy process by which no one, like someone would just sort of show up and figure out how to get a show on IRC and say, we're indie media someplace or other. And we would just make them a website because we like wrote some script to like copy and paste the websites and so we could make them really, really easily. And there was a while when we didn't know who was running one of these websites. Like we didn't collect email addresses, like any contact information at all. Just like if someone showed up and said, you know, I'm in this place and I'm indie media, we just said, sure, here you go. And we linked to it. And then eventually there needed to be some process.
Right, there needed to be process. There also needed to be face-to-face organizing and meeting some of these people. So we did take it to the next level. I solicited like $5,000, I think, and organized a caravan of indie media activists to travel through South America. Ravel was one of the people. So bringing along the techies who just press a button and voila, magic happens, they actually got to be in the meetings and listen to some of the conflicts and problems and issues that came up. For example, in Bolivia, I remember we were, you know, all the activists in Cochabamba, and then all the rural indigenous folks, and sitting down in many hour-long meetings about the needs of different communities and how they're going to be represented, and did the indigenous people feel comfortable being represented as Bolivia IMC, and having someone like Ravel there to like talk through some possible solutions to that, both social and technical solutions, you know, and having them become part of the process in a more real way was really important. We went to Argentina as well, and there we worked with a radio station, a somewhat conservative union, but who was interested in this, obviously working with factory workers and some anarchist kids. And we, again, hours-long meetings about how all these different groups with different politics and different memberships could integrate and collaborate. And that was 1 year before the uprising in Argentina. So a year later, when all hell broke loose on the streets, there was infrastructure, there were people who were already educated and plugged in and resourced with ways to do independent media, which was huge. And then the workers took over the factories and they were using the indie media newswires to communicate with each other, post meeting notes, their communiques, their constitutions, and it became an organizing platform in and of itself. So some of those personal relationships came.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting aspects that relates back to the discussion this morning was when we started to do this sort of north-south collaboration, there was a lot of pushback of, you know, what are you wealthy American white media activists coming here to do stuff? And it was involved a lot of process, a lot of talking to figure out how to make sure that it was not a one-way street, but it was a matter of how do we create real solidarity and how do we create real collaboration? And it was like, the cultural gaps between different people participating in it were huge and made it very hard. At one point, I think there was a rule that you had to write every email to the list in multiple languages,
right,
for inclusion.
Right.
So we're gonna be inclusive by saying only people who are bilingual can participate in the discussions.
That's the proposal for Euskera?
Yeah.
All talking in Euskera from now on.
Yeah. I don't know if you want to talk about the experience.
Well, so it's part of First off, I just want to say I'm meeting people who worked on projects that we were affiliated with or supported for the first time. And that is a deeply satisfying feeling. So thank you to the organizers for making that happen in my life. I had an interesting experience as I was trying to get ready for this. I actually found my World Trade Organization protest diary, which has personal things in it, so I did not ship it to Trish and Renee. I was looking through, and one of the things that really struck me was that most of the diary was, like over half of it, is actually information about the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, structural adjustment, many things with two political science degrees I did not know a whole lot about. And then there's a little bit about the cops beating and gassing us and how terrible it was and how traumatizing. But I really looked back at this and realized that I had learned a lot, that I had kind of squeezed a year of school. I was a grad school dropout, like a year of school in 3 days at this space. And just thinking about what happens when the function of a protest or a gathering or a happening or an intervention that is actually a deeply educational space for folks. And like one of the big takeaways is inspiration, connection with others, and education in that, in addition to, you know, fucking up the WTO's agenda, or at least helping Africa do so. So the second thing I found was the very first notes. I had to do some digging for this, but this is our first independent media meeting. These were the notes. See, and then I found the list of people and also what they could offer. So like, you know, someone's got a microphone and somebody has a, you know, camera and this and that, because at that time we didn't have all those things. And I found, you know, like our to-do list. So it's a little to-do list. Anyway, so I was thinking a little, so I'm from Urbana, Champaign Independent Media Center, and although some folks call us the flyover zone, one of the things that we, you know, we're a smaller community that ended up having this kind of strange position within the independent media network, which is that we helped to sponsor a lot of the projects sitting in the room. And by sponsorship, I don't mean something highfalutin like we did all the work for you, because we didn't. But we were we often channeled money, managed money. We were the first 501c3 in the network. There was a certain amount of kerfluffle about that. And we really were focused on building infrastructure. And so I think Urbana IMC really represents a corner of the independent media movement that was looking to do long-haul organizing and power building and institution building. There were a number of us who were doing this work where indie media kind of flowed into the flow, you know? So instead of it's like we came out of indie media, it's more like indie media came in and augmented and enhanced and created this amazing international network for us to continue to work. So I wanted to share a little bit about our origin story, primarily through the principles that we had when we created Urbana IMC. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about the future and where I think, so kind of like starting with the beginning and kind of where we went, and then talk about some of the offerings I would put on the table for discussion about where I think we're going. And by that, I don't necessarily mean the brand indie media, but our movements and the work that we've been doing and the work represented in this room. So when we started, we were artists and organizers, always those two entities kind of holding hands. And we always had an interest in working inside and outside systems. So we bridged, like, you know, anarchism to running people for different political office. And we were kind of comfortably, sometimes it's the dynamics of a smaller community that you actually have to learn to get along with each other, because like those people don't go away. Like, you can't just go to Manhattan and forget those people in Brooklyn, you know? Like, they're in your space and your face all the time. And so some folks consider the Midwest to be polite, and I think a big piece of that is because we have to live with each other every day. So we really, you know, a year after we started our independent media center, not even, less than a year, I won and a seat on city council. So as a founder of IMC, as a person who consider myself politically most aligned with anarchists, I was one of two people I've known. The other was Kara Jennings, who served as a city council member in Lake Worth, who started radical cheerleading. She also, you know, she and I were some of the folks, it was a very small pool of anarchists who served on city councils across the country. The second thing I think was that we always wanted to be a nursery of projects, and we still are to this day. And so being able to support the Mobile Eye and South America Independent New York IMC, we actually have the distinguishing description of supporting both Palestine IMC and Israel IMC. I don't know how we did that, but we did. And so we supported Alive in Baghdad, which was the first reporting that was happening after the saturation bombing. And so we were trying to really, like, be the kind of financial geekery arm of the indie media movement to hold down in our little bank account in Urbana, in our credit union, U of I Credit Union. You keep all the money for Global IMC, and we can, for that fund, which is separate from Global IMC. There's a lot of fights about that. We were the Global IMC fund, and then we held monies for, you know, I used to sign the lease for New York IMC, and I was telling John, who I met yesterday for the first time, but we've been working together for 20 years. When I used to sign his lease, I would do this. I did. I would just, like, cover my eyes and be like, oh, I hope these people are not terrorists or crazy people. Because I'm, like, signing for real estate in New York, but because I have so few assets, I don't fucking care. Because I guess, you know, how are they going to come after us?
We never missed a payment.
What's that?
We never missed a payment.
Exactly. They were great, actually. We were really, in many ways, we were aligned with New York IMC because we were interested in developing a long-haul infrastructure for our movements. And the fact that the independent exists to this day is real testimony to that. And y'all should come back tomorrow because I know John is going to be talking about that. The other piece was that we were really focused on amplifying, not controlling, that's an important piece, right? Amplifying, we're the amplification of underrepresented people and perspectives. And so we brought together identity and ideas, which I think is an important piece of it. I think sometimes we have this black faces in high places, which, you know, that the whole march of, you know, African Americans into police chief positions and heads of housing authorities, and we've seen what that comes of it. And we also have, you know, long-standing kind of white, liberal, exclusionary way of doing things where these communities are separate, the white, progressive, well-meaning white, liberal community and folks of color. And I think from the beginning we were really trying to, like, make spaces. Sometimes those were parallel spaces, and sometimes over time with trust they joined, and that's been an important piece of our work. We, because we wanted to build infrastructure, our second day, I actually found the notes so I can, like, have proof. The second thing, we decided to purchase property. I didn't realize it was so soon in the process. Seems like
your second day, you decided?
The second day, we were like, we're buying property. And it was because we saw a lot of movements who had a sugar daddy or sugar mommy who, like, bought a space, and then people would pour their lives into these spaces, right? And then all of a sudden someone would get into financial difficulty, or the person would pass or something, and they would lose their space. And we saw that a lot. And so we really thought independent means independent, meaning that we actually have to control the property. And this became important because at some point we actually had our space shut down by the city. That's happened twice. The third time was this summer. I'll get to that in a second. But we had our space shut down because we were over-occupied. We had too many people we were trying to put in the space, the shows, the art events. I mean, we just didn't have enough space. And so we really felt, and our, we could, it was because our landlord wouldn't do what he said he was supposed to do and help us with the electrical and these pieces. So as a result, we were like, screw it, we're out of here. So $8,000 of small, locally raised money gave us a down payment to purchase the post office. And you might have seen some of the pictures that were up before. I just offered those photos so you could see. We have a 30,000 square foot post office, you know, big columns, Gothic columns, in downtown, like the very center of the downtown, you know, a block from the library, a block from the high school, right next to the business district. And we were really trying to, you know, occupy space and like become, like represent our community from the inside. So now we're like the destination in Urbana. I mean, we don't count unique individuals, but we'll have over 200,000 visits in a year to our space. And so there's constant flow in and out. I would say from the beginning, I mentioned we were artists and organizers, but we always thought of media as art and narrative and story. Because very early on in the process, and we actually went through multiple design sessions, we really talked about what do we mean by media. And we thought that one of the problems is that if it looks like media and it smells like media, then people call it media. If it has that objective journalistic kind of format, then folks assume that that's media. And so you might have seen some of the protest dresses on the second floor that I painted as part of a protest dress series. You know, to me, that's media. That's message and making statements. And it was very effective because we learned at Seattle that they would take your signs away from you. And so I decided I'm never showing up to a protest again where they can take my signs away and make me look like I'm part of a gang or a group of people on the street just making trouble. So I was like, from now on, I want to go elegantly and I want to wear my sign so they can't take it away. So that's where the protest dresses came from. So we always wanted to make a space for people to come together and in person, but also digitally, really as an augmentation to the in-person, to be curious together and to design solutions. So we really wanted to be a place where people could come and there wasn't just what we, you know, there's not one solution we're selling. We're making space for people to discuss their problems. And that means the space has to be open for people to discuss in all the various ways that they do. And we're not going to decide that, like, you know, this particular ideology, like communism is not the solution, yoga is not the solution, you know, hydroponics is not the solution, right? But these are all solutions that are welcome to be discussed in this space. And so we really saw that part of what we were seeing with the shrinking of the media landscape was that we were not able to see our own power. And so we talked about independent media as foraging for consequences, like foraging the way a pig forages for like truffles, you know? So we asked the question, would the civil rights movement of the 60s, if it were happening in our own backyard, would we even see it or recognize it? And we were really thinking that in many ways, no, because the media landscape had consolidated to the, you know, the Big Ten, that in many ways, we couldn't really see ourselves, that every day people are organizing and making change happen. But if we can't see it, the consequences of our actions, then we're not able to really grow our movements. And we saw this as a central locus of control, right? Because the old school version of control is to keep you from speaking, right, Evan? Or to keep you from being in the streets or acting. But it seemed like, okay, go ahead and put 1.5 million people in the streets in New York City to protest the war. Go ahead and, you know, get the bodies out there, because if we don't print it the next day, which is what happened with the biggest protest in U.S. history as of that time, where it didn't even make it above the fold in the New York Times, like, to me, that was such a sign that you can control, you let everyone do their games, right, in the street, but as long as no one sitting in their armchairs knew it happened, then we're good, you know? We don't have to do that violent repression of speech. which is honestly a lot more expensive and kind of bloody and terrible. It makes the cops look bad and they lose their jobs, like the police chief did in Seattle. So I think that we have to, this is getting to the forward piece, but we have to really continue to understand that there are interventions happening at every moment on every level. There's three people around a kitchen table, that's the kitchen table theme, like scheming, right? And so like, how do we amplify that conversation or the consequences of that? How do we make it bigger? And so we have a radio station that's attached to a stage, that's attached to a newspaper, a website, a social media presence. And we basically open our center up for anyone who is a member, which is $0 to $50 a year, or organizational member, $100 a year, to come use our space anytime it's not used. So the IMC is full all the time. Like, I'll walk in and there'll be like reading group over here and potluck over there, and all they did was throw it on the calendar, which is very chaotic and makes some people angry, but it works. It's just messy, but it works to allow people to self-organize, provide that self-organizing space. This may be obvious, but I think it's important that, of course, indie media is about turning consumers into producers, but we oftentimes talk about producing what? Certainly producing media. Okay, we could say producing stories, but actually what people are producing is themselves, right? You're producing yourself, you're producing your community, you're producing culture. And so I think from the beginning, we really thought of inspiring consumers to be producers of their lives and understand the vital role of like narrative and art in doing that. The last thing I'll say is that, you know, youth have school and home, and it's so important that we make third places for young people to be in. I mean, I probably would not be sitting in front of you right now if it wasn't for a little theater in Gainesville, Florida, called the Crosstown Repertory Theater, where I could go be my little queer self at 16 and like hang out with friends on top of a U-Haul and write poetry and plays and like deal with the demons that I had. And so my third place was that space, and it's really important that, you know, because that those transition years are so hard for our young people, to be able to provide kind of spaces for them to be themselves is so important, and that's something that we wanted. I will just fast forward to...
Can I just ask, sure, please. One of the things I saw spending time with the sort of indie media movement here in the United States or North America, but also Latin America and Europe, was in Europe and in Latin America, they had these social centers. They had these spaces that had already existed in Europe. They squatted spaces in Latin America. They found ways, because real estate was very cheap, to make these sort of physical spaces where communities can come together and organize and work. And one of the things that felt like an innovation for a while in the US was indie media said, we need that kind of space here in North America. We need to make space where you can come and do that. And I think that's one of the things we learned from Europe. And in Europe, they just put the indie media center in the social centers that they already had. But I don't, other than champagne, a lot of us didn't manage to get our own spaces we could control.
Real estate's a little more expensive where you all live than where I live, which is a piece of the equation, is that you're like dealing with trying to reclaim spaces and then gentrifying areas. You know, like the new sanctuary for independent media, you all be talking tomorrow. You definitely want to hear their story. It's amazing. But they're an example of a space where things were, you know, some of the spaces that have sprung up in Detroit, in Troy, in Urbana, are in part because the real estate situation is very different. And so it is worth a question for us to engage with, is how in big cities, with the real estate market, what it is, how do you actually create space? And maybe it is house theaters and, you know, people's apartments and like having a network of spaces. And certainly, Anna, I'm interested in hearing more about the Mayday space as well on that regard.
Yeah, and this topic came up last night. I think physical spaces is key at this point when social media, everyone has a camera in their pocket. We need now ways to bring everybody together. And certainly no easy task. Physical space is a lot of work. Takes a lot of money, especially in Brooklyn. In our case, we had a decent landlord who was building a new building, and we had a long relationship with him, just as tenants in his buildings. And he said, I'm building a new building, it's not residential, I don't know what to do with it. So we're like, oh, we know. So we started talking to a lot of community groups, Make the Road by Walking was gonna move in, a local high school youth group was gonna build a garden on the roof, and we opened a community space, community center, and a social justice bar that groups could use as a public-facing event space. And a lot of things happened. The building took way longer to get its New York City inspection process is insane. It took like 3 years. And at the time, Black Lives Matter was popping off, and we decided, you know what, we can't wait for this anymore. So we talked with a local church and decided to move the community center into that church, just so we could just start doing the work. And it was amazing. The biggest thing that came out of that was actually an arts collective. People wanted to come together. Again, they didn't need to make their own media because they could do that anywhere, but they wanted community. And so making banners, making arts, making protest dresses, that really brought people into the community, having dinners. And that's now evolved into a lot of workshops, a lot of classes on gentrification, on language classes, salsa classes, a lot of workshops, and media literacy classes and political education classes. And I do think that if there's always a way to do it. If you just have to partner with the right people. Someone has space that might be willing to work with you. So it's finding those people and making those connections, and whichever way you got to do it. And I should say, Star Bar stayed in that original building and is also really a vibrant space for people to celebrate and dance together and hold public events. So.
And does Star Bar finance the Mayday space at all?
Partially. I mean, I think Mayday space is actually doing better than the bar. But,
okay.
10% of the profits go to Mayday space.
Okay.
And I know that now where I live in Portland, we've basically rolled through space after space after space, and eventually got to the point where the Radical Bookstore got moved further and further away from the center of town, so that it was very hard to get to, and eventually the space where the radio programs were produced got lost, and sort of the moment in which you had a down thing in organizing, you lost the space because you didn't have enough money to keep it going. And then now that we have a very large amount of anti-fascist organizing in Portland, we don't have a space to do that in. So we lost the space and we didn't get it back. Even though there's an upswing in organizing and activism, and a tremendous amount of social media sort of creation and fighting over things, but you know, the space isn't there anymore.
Same in a lot of places. Austin, there's no cheap warehouses left. I was up in Portland. You guys are being inundated by developers too. And it's just another byproduct of the cancerous capitalism. It's just mowing over things. Entire neighborhoods disappear in our town.
So I was at a session with Starhawk, if you remember Starhawk. Uh-huh. And Starhawk was basically said that we need to be buying property.
Right.
Because the way that Starhawk and her community has managed to maintain themselves is that they bought property in the Mission when it was affordable or when it was a stretch to get it. And so as soon as we can think of it, we can create ways in which we can transfer the title to collectively held institutions, we can keep them for longer.
And this gets to some future piece of the conversation. I think like RIMC hit dirt financially a year after Trump was elected, which makes no sense. It had nothing to do with the political culture. It had to do with financial mismanagement. And we've now rectified that, and we're totally in the black, and, you know, but it's like, we had a real scary moment, because you get a board in, and a staff member, and they just, like, want to increase their salary, and they don't think it's their problem, or they don't, you know, and it's, like, very easy to lose that space, and And so we're actually, because we had this experience that was so scary for us, we are thinking about moving it into a trust. So actually, as a land trust, some crazy board that got elected yesterday by the IMC membership because people were feeling burnt out can't just like sell it or do something,
right?
So I think we're looking for how to for land trusts. The second piece, and you know, 70% of our income at our IMC comes from rents. And honestly, that's a very stable model for us because we have this priority of like, you could be anybody except, you know, someone is totally like outside our, like against our mission, and we'll rent you at like premium office space. And if you are a nonprofit, there's a nonprofit rate. And if you are a affiliated organization, there's this rate. And if you're a working group, it's like basically what you can pay is what people, what the group pays towards it. And so that fluctuates based on money they have in the bank. And that works really well for us. And it's a way that it's a model to get property, but you have to have a property manager that doesn't always, like that's a different brain sometimes than the brain that does street protests. So, so, you know, like being smart about making sure that you have your financial degree is there along with your media degree and your tech degree and whatnot.
Can I jump in? So like we, on the tech side, we actually sort of ran into a very similar set of problems where for the first several years of Indie Media, we did lots of active development in different kinds of, different, you know, Mirror and Active and all these other variations on code for the publishing. But people were only, people either needed a way of supporting themselves while they did that work, which mostly meant they lived in social democratic countries in Europe and they could be unemployed and live in social centers and support themselves, or they needed to figure out a way to do work. And so the way to do work was we set up all these tech co-ops that would then sell software development and design services to social movement groups. But social movement groups don't really have much money. And those groups are still around. They mix between working for nonprofits and NGOs, and but they don't, that didn't give any space for building new things. And the things we had for Indie Media, we were super concerned about the power of the technologists getting to drive what happened. And so we had this thing where we said, well, this is definitely like changing the way the newswire works or the way publishing works or adding logins or all this, and that's really something that should be consensus over. And so we had a situation where people who didn't understand the work of software development would just be able to say, well, I like it the way it is, I'm going to block any changes. And so it pushed the software development out of the sphere of Indie Media and into parallel things, either into tech co-ops or a group of people, myself included, sort of said, can we just get jobs that let us do the same thing as Indie Media? And so we got jobs building what became social media, but we lost the collective ownership of it. So we got the resources to build it, and we then took the ideas of Indie Media, participatory media, in the case of Flickr and Craigslist and YouTube and Twitter, the most direct example. And we got the ideas and the practices, but we lost the ownership. And so, you know, Twitter is the best example. There was a project, which a lot of you probably remember, in 2004 called TextMob, which was connected to the Yes Men and Indie Media and all sorts of people you could do. And you would have Indie Media breaking news sent out in text messages in other groups, like affinity groups. That very project was taken into the company that myself and Blaine, who was an Indie Media and tech collective activist from Vancouver, and we showed it to the people at the internet company, Odeo, where we worked, and we said, this is really cool. And the company said, oh yeah, let's figure out if there's something here, and took TextMob, analyzed it, changed it, and that became Twitter. And so we got the ideas of the tools we were building out to a world where we got resources that we couldn't sort of manage, but we lost ownership of it. And like, so So then you see this thing where, you know, like Black Lives Matter uses hashtags to organize, and, you know, the Arab Spring and all these other movements are using these tools that we, the movement, created for movement building, but we've lost that ownership of the platform because we could never figure out how to own the building.
Isn't that kind of like when the artists come in and they renovate the buildings, and then gentrifiers come in and they're like, ooh, you did this cool thing, and they, I mean, it's like, in a non-spatial way, it's kind of, you know, how do we make really amazing, cool things in an environment, a capitalist environment that is like all about co-optation? Like, that's what it does best, is it steals and grabs ideas and tries to figure out how to make a profit, and it puts like capital behind it really fast, and it grows really fast. And yeah. It's almost like, I don't want to say it's an inevitability, but it feels like it's very difficult to produce anything and feel like you can hold on to it.
Yeah, so it's like the artists could continue to use the space, but they no longer get the rules about how the space is run. Mm-hmm. So they created the space, they found a corporation to sort of keep it running, and then get to keep using it, but don't get the control, don't get the say. And so we lost, like, we became the media, and now everybody on their cell phone creates their own media, but we don't own the platform. And I think we don't own the platform because we couldn't figure out and decide how to build it and how to fund that building and how to make decisions about it. And that, I mean, to me, that's one of the sort of successes and failings of indie media.
Mm-hmm. And we've lost a lot of data privacy and security, but you're working on that now. So talking about features, can you talk a little bit about some of the software ideas that you think might solve, you know, address some of these issues that have come up since the corporatization?
Yeah, so, you know, seeing this process and playing an active role in it, I looked at emerging technologies and tried to figure out sort of, okay, how do we fix this mistake we made? And about 5 years ago, a bunch of anarchist hackers living off the grid and on sailboats in New Zealand and on this weird commune in Hawaii started creating a new database technology called Scuttlebutt. And it's been sort of evolving as this collectively held technology that doesn't have any central servers at all. It doesn't have any way of doing it. And so we've been looking at saying, okay, how do we build something that's like the new existing social media platforms we have now out there in the world, but can't be owned by a corporation and can't be owned by an individual, but each person sort of participates in the network. And for the last 2 years, that's what I've been working on full time, and sort of saying, okay, how do we do this thing of like making something we can all build on that gives us something that feels like Instagram or feels like Twitter, but never goes through a server and doesn't have advertising, and you control your data and you get end-to-end encryption like Signal. And I actually ran into the same problem that we had with the existing time of like, how do we make something like TextMob reach a mass audience, is that the social media and the social movements don't have the structure to do the design work. And they don't have the structure to do the product work that would make it a mass audience. And so I've been trying to walk this sort of narrow line of taking money from people like Bloomberg to build something, claiming that it's going to be a business, and that building it on this collective platform that, so like, I did create a business and got investment, but we don't own it. Like, we don't own the relationship, we don't own your identity, we don't own your participation. And so, but I don't know if that's going to work, but like, we need to build sort of new alternatives. And so that's what we've been doing within Scuttlebutt. And the Scuttlebutt community is informed by the experience of indie media. And although it's got different structures and is the same sets of people having the same discussions of like, how do we create autonomous communications infrastructure that we can own, but isn't captured in such a way.
We could open it up if folks want to jump in. I'm sure you all have a lot to say about all of this.
Yes.
the past few years, and it's always really interesting, like, looking at spaces, and I think, like, when you're thinking of, like, activist spaces and stuff like that, it's also asking, what do people need? And one thing that I really like in Amsterdam is a space called Binnenfret. Binnenfret's like a huge complex. It was squatted in the early 80s. And it, amongst all the things it has a restaurant, a music studio, a free store, a library, I think that's a concert space. And it also has a thing called Kinderpret. And this, for me, is great. I'm a dad. So 2 days a week, they offer activities for kids. You can basically take your kids there and do stuff like that. So, you know, I think about like that, like thinking of these spaces is not just the spaces that we can go and organize, the spaces of social reproduction. Because the interesting thing too, you know, having a kid start at your own time, is you're always thinking like, I don't want my kid to rebel against me. You know, you want your kid to grow up in an environment that nurtures their learning and that they don't feel weird, you know, and like rolled against you. Interesting thing about Kinderpret is there's kids that now grown up now started bands or playing in the Oki and blues stuff. And the space doesn't have this weird stigma. It's not like some punky, scary space. Like, it's a real nice place. Like, Oki has, you know, Sun Ra Orchestra come and play, and there's somewhere to residency, like bands that actually people want to go see, along with activist bands and stuff like that. So I think it's like building spaces and owning them, but also thinking about what do people need that we can provide that the community doesn't have already.
Yeah, I would say what in reflecting on the future, I think both because we're becoming poorer and people's material needs are much more relevant to them, but also because we really need to be doing tools training and power building with the poor, and that I think the looking at how we could help to generate jobs through cooperatives, how we can do childcare, how we can address food shortages through a rotating set of potlucks. We're seeing that at our IMC. We have now 3 or 4 potlucks each week. And my current job is I'm an elected official in our community. I run a township, which is dedicated to supporting the homeless and near homeless. So that's my day job. I've started to refer people over to the IMC, which is 2 blocks away, to be like, hey, there's like 3 potlucks that are open to the community a week. And I've started to see folks move over there. And the township has started to do more events. And we really see people coming together around food to address that piece, and having after school programming all of a sudden meets a material need in that way. So I really think that, you know, in some ways, like getting a really thinking about both like a business plan that involves having long-term strategic stability that doesn't compromise the mission, and if anything helps to support that mission. And then also looking at like, how do you create an incubator space to develop for people to meet their own needs? And sometimes that's very material kinds of needs for them. I think is a really important part of thinking about our future of you know, our organizing future together.
I'm curious how many people in the audience have a space in their community that they use for organizing or media making. Just about half.
Out of
we started indiespaces.net.
it is the independent media center. I mean, the physical space of it has always been quite important. And I think we forget that when we talk about the digital aspects of it or all the different media making is like part of what distinguished indie media from previous projects was not only was there a physical space during a protest, but there was an intention to try and keep those physical spaces ongoing, and in some of the cases they've really continued and some they haven't, but I think it's really important that we realize that this physical space to meet and form community is critical to what indie media is.
I think on that realm, what you were saying about the diversity of your space of in Illinois, you know, if we were all independent musicians, we'd be having this exact same discussion. If we were all independent food producers, same discussion, independent artists. And all those things, all those not selling plastic widgets. You're trying to maintain some culture and education. But, you know, obviously networking with these other socially and movement-aligned groups who aren't activists but are still in the slow media, slow arts, slow food, you know, taking it down to that level of when you're of community. And I think encouraging those alliances between artists and activists, between food producers and activists.
Renee, you want to say something?
I just wanted to throw out something into the conversation about how some of the centers that we had as independent media centers were somewhat temporary, like you mentioned, Anna, I think in New York, like walking into the IMC during the IMF World Bank protests. And basically, many of us remember these convergence space IMCs, basically, right, that were created, that came together for a purpose, a tactical purpose, and then, you know, went away physically as spaces, as I recall, most of the time. And just kind of throwing that into the conversation about the spaces we can create. It's not all specifically a building, per se, and sometimes temporary is fine. You know, at a convergence, for example, we've got these RFC and DCNCs coming up, for example, in 2020, and I usually end up there as part of the Democracy Now! Team, but I think, you know, where is that space these days? Does it exist? I don't want to be so presumptuous to think that no one is organizing it, but just to kind of think about that as part of our work, too, and part of the space discussion.
Yeah. Right.
That was a good segue. I was just wondering what people think about the transition to more live sort of media also, and how that's impacted, you know, produced pieces. I feel like there's less interest in that and more interest in the immediacy of, you know, something that's live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that has made it so that space isn't required. You know, I guess I always had Pacifica to work out of in Houston, but most of that I just did at home, you know, on my laptop. So I think having infrastructure might have made it more difficult, because then you're worried about paying the bills and keeping that center going more so than doing the actual work.
This is definitely a danger. You know, that's the other side of having a space is bills and rent and all of that, which can be a distraction from the mission.
The live part, the immediacy component.
Mm-hmm. Personally, I think that's a double-edged sword, and because yes, you can see anything on the moment, but a lot of people, especially teachers of young people these days, have told me that they. Even young people complain to them that they're missing some context and everything's just coming out of nowhere, and it's not contextualized, there's no historical context. Jackie and I were talking about this, like I was saying that I, more edited pieces that put together a whole era or a whole thought process or a whole, context is the word. They're sorely needed, and it takes a lot of work, and it takes, you know, resources and collaboration to make those pieces happen. But I think that the process of doing so builds stronger, longer-term relationships, too. So I do think it's worthwhile.
One of the things, like, was the indie media model was we would have a protest on an issue and we would get lots of riot porn. And then we would have a conference on the issue and we would get lots of academics and well-educated activists on it, and we would record all their talks and interviews. And then we would mix the riot porn of the protest with the intellectuals talking about it to be an education piece, and then we would do it, then we would take that around and we would show it as a community organizing tool, as a video, and it was really effective. And that works. I mean, but the live streaming thing, it's like also worth remembering that, like, we did live streaming in Seattle during the WTO in 1999. Like, that was the first time I ever heard of someone doing live streaming. We had a laptop, and we had a Ricochet modem, and we had a video camera, and we were doing live streaming, you know, 20 years ago. And so, like, it's great that there's all these people doing it, because we figured out how to do it, and now it's a hell of a lot easier.
the problems that we're facing is that around the country there's over 1,000 public access centers that have just been put on high alert and are immediately threatened by FCC ruling, which says that they the cable companies can count anything they give them, which could be like the physically the line that goes to the community, the board, the town council meeting or whatever, or the TV channel that it's on, so that they don't have to give any funding at all. They can count everything as in-kind donation, and that they can give whatever fucking value they want to it. It's like
it's real bad.
And so, but they have to. They're required in many cities and states to give 5%. Well, they can jack that all those figures up really easily. So be 5% that they don't have to give any funding at all. So a lot of centers are really threatened by that. And in addition, there was a Supreme Court ruling in my case, which basically was that I was banned from public access in New York City. And and my friend Capoletto Melendez, a Puerto Rican poet, the two of us were banned from being on any use of the channel or the space. We went to court. We won at the U.S. Circuit Court. And they said public access is a fundamental right, and that it was a violation of our First Amendment rights. And Manhattan Neighborhood Network took that to, they appealed that, and they said no, public access is private, and that they do not have to adhere to the First Amendment at all. Now, this got no coverage in mainstream media, but there was tons. If you Google Melendez and Halleck and SCOTUS, there are all these legal blogs that have articles about it. Now, why did the legal community take this up? Because it's an incredibly important case that actually says that nonprofit, if a private organization can like a charter school or a prison, a private prison, do not have to adhere to any of the amendments, not just the First Amendment. So it's like it has incredible legal importance, and I think that just in terms of access to spaces, etc., public access is really an important venue for many cities. It doesn't work very well, like in Manhattan, it's a farce. But it works in Brooklyn, there's terrific access in Brooklyn. But in Philadelphia, fantastic. In different places around the country, it's almost like an independent media center. It's like really places where people are able to produce and collaborate and really make podcasts together or whatever. But it's not only is the space and the funding a threat, but that right now any producer in the public access, even though it's the public access channel, like some of them have government and educational channels, but the public access channels, which used to be first come, first serve, that is over now. That it is now that the public access administrators, if they're a non-profit private organization, they do not have to adhere to the First Amendment. So we've lost that.
And we never did we never did as good a job as we could have of taking advantage of those sort of public access channels and public access spaces. But a few places people used it as political tools, but lots of places it was just sort of ignored and was a tremendous resource.
Yeah, and just on that topic, I think one of the things looking forward is that radio stations are struggling in the same way public access stations are, as our community media centers, historic centers. And, you know, honestly, in the business world, consolidation oftentimes happens at those moments. And there's a reason for that. I think that it when we were looking to start new low-power FM stations at Prometheus Radio Project, we reached out to all the public access stations. We got a list from ACM of everyone, and we like blasted them multiple times with like, do you want to have a conversation? We can get on the phone, like, you know, would you like to start, like, basically have a license that you can air your public access? And I think that, you know, I was really pushing for a community media center approach that integrates where appropriate. Not, I mean, some communities really can bear multiple stations. We have two community stations that don't necessarily want to merge right now, although I think within 10 years that will happen. So, but I think it would be helpful for us to think about, like, as the environment is shifting and folks are producing media on their own, and we have to really think, like, how do we make that relevant, purposeful community building space where there's layers called low power FM. I think yesterday I was saying, don't call it radio anymore, just call it a community music studio. And then all of a sudden, because we've got like five community music studios in our community, right? Everybody wants a community music studio right now. It's like, great, this is one. It's called WRFU, but you can call it whatever you want. So, like, layer public access. Right now, our public access channel came to us seeing that they were going to lose funds going forward and said, would the IMC like to run our public access channel? Right now, we're saying, no, you need to do it because you do it well and fight them, and we want to work with you. But, you know, it may be that the best thing for our community is to bring these things together. So just something to consider is, like, tracking what's happening in your community with community radio and public access and seeing if, like, we could be stronger together and overcoming some of those, like, you know, there's, you know, little fiefdoms that happen in our communities. And so there's, like, relationship building that needs to happen over time to get over some of the ego that comes with those silos so that we can preserve these institutions.
In the back.
Yeah, it's a really important conversation. I think that I'm really, this story about, really, we're talking about Twitter, you know, having our ideas appropriated from us. I think that in media, as organizers, that happens to us all the time. And it's really kind of pulled us as to where a lot of times now, if you were like, if I want to share some art, I could either do it at the bookstore and, like, you know, hopefully we can get like six or seven people there, or I can put it on online, which is the entire world. And there's not a lot of spaces for kind of cultivating this 200 to 2,000 sort of community-based political, organizing spaces. And that one of the things that's so hard about that is the internet. And it's just this, you know, the more and more we can create, everyone's got a phone, but like everyone uses Facebook. And, you know, that has some proto-fascist tendencies. And, you know, with the
original investors were the CIA.
Right. So I guess my question actually comes from, inspired by this conversation about radio especially, you know, can we reformat the internet around physical spaces and communities as an internet? And I actually did not come up with that idea. It came from Colombia, where the indigenous people are saying, why don't we build our own internet from the ground up so that, that our languages, you know, the internet in this area will be rooted in the language and the knowledge of our people here, and then that can slowly connect with another internet over there, and we'll build up this sort of organic indigenous internet. And people are right actively trying to build that in Colombia right now. And I'm interested in what y'all are thinking in terms of what would be that next phase in sort of building regional hubs of essentially information or knowledge that we can tap into that are not universal corporate and they're not just hyper-individual either, but they're really kind of rooted in communities or geographies or regions.
So that sort of ideas is a lot of what the sort of in the Scuttlebutt community have been thinking about. We have two projects. One is developed in a village in the interior of Brazil, which is to try and build software for people who are both literate and semi-literate but have Android phones so that they can do social media. And even though the village only has a mesh Wi-Fi network that has intermittent connections to the rest of the world, and so the ability to share and publish amongst the community within the village so people can see it. The other project is specifically working with a Maori group where they're trying to create autonomously controlled identities of relationships and publishing using the Scuttlebutt protocol called Ahu. And the idea is, how do you model their traditional models of defining who has a space and what it is and what the relationships are on a set of technologies that don't necessarily have to be hosted on a central server, but exist as sort of held communally. And you know, there's the work I'm doing, which is such much more sort of using the same set of technology as a social media platform. And I think these are some really interesting experiments of like, what is the physical space? And like, one of the aspects of Scuttlebutt is there's, you can put it on a local thing where you're in a Wi-Fi network, you notice it and you sync because you're physically in proximity with other people who have it. And that's sort of the way by default it's expected to work. And then the reality is we're not physically connected often with each other in the same space, so we had to make it work in other ways. But I think there's a lot of interesting experiments there. What is the future of sort of, what is the future of community controlled technology?
Yeah, I just wonder if you guys could comment a little bit on getting paid for doing in the media work, because that was always like a big point of contention. And I just speak from my own personal experience, but I wouldn't have been able to do what I've been doing for such a long time if I wouldn't draw even the meager income that I was able to draw from this small donations and crowdfunding.
Yeah, that was always a big topic of conversation. And I mean, just from the network perspective, I mean, the idea and the principle was that Indie Media Global was not going to decide this for anyone, and that it was a bottom-up decision. So if a local INC wanted to do it, they could and should. Of course, that never really played out. Like, whenever someone decided in Bolivia that they wanted to start paying INC people, someone from the other side of the world would freak out about it, and there'd be long email conversations, and that took a lot of, that wore a lot of us out. Just like, okay, maybe this is not going to work. But, you know, I personally think that local chapters should and did decide what worked best for them. Again, the tension within local IMCs, and we face this in New York, is, well, why is this person's work more valuable than all the work I'm doing? I have another job, I have kids, and I want to be doing this full time too. So, you know, but I think you can work that out locally very easily, and New York City did, and Urbana did.
Well, the way we handled it is because it always creates problems when someone gets paid for something that someone else does for volunteer.
Right.
So we created, there was a group of us, the IMC and a tech company that I was partnered in for 15 years. We had a mission to create high-paying part-time work for artists and activists, and we were actually growing up at the same time as the IMC, so it didn't sprout out. But a lot of our people volunteered at the IMC, so the IMC was like strictly volunteer space. But people who were making media, who were savvy, were like hired on to our tech collective. And then once you were there for like 6 or 9 months, you could become an owner. So it was a kind of a worker co-op. And that, you know, like my goal was, and I got this from Dave Dellinger actually, went from Yale to Jail, and he came to town, and I asked him this question when I was like 20, and he was like, we started a print shop so that we could publish and print things. And I was like, brilliant, that's what I'm going to do. So I basically, when, you know, the new school ran me out because I was organizing the guards union, I was like, shit, what am I going to do? I'm not going to be a professor, which I didn't really want anyway, or a lawyer, which I decided not was a very good idea. But I was like, I need, you know, every time I try to do my work, I'm run, you know, I get into trouble with the administration. So I really felt like my independence relied on me working with friends to build something. And we really exclusively worked for university and nonprofit clients. We did a little bit of stuff with businesses, but, you know, when the Prince of Dubai came, this is a true story, and like wanted to hire us to do some shit, and there were people in our collective who were not aligned with the IMC or political, they're like, great, that's a lot of money. I was like, read Mike Davis's story, you know, like, here, like, we can take this job, but you have to read this 100-page article first. And that was the end of that. We were not going to take money from the Prince of Dubai after that. But, you know, so I think it's really important to, like, I would say, like, keep it separate, you know, in some ways so that you don't have, you're not having to manage, like, consensus volunteer stuff with business tech collective. But they can feed each other. I mean, we ran the Wi-Fi, you know, Pixo, it's now called Pixo Technologies. At the time, it was called On the Job Consulting until we found out that in London, on the job means you're hooking it. So I had to change the name. But, you know, we thought we were, like, learning on the job. So, you know, that was our but we, you know, we helped to provide and a lot of work to bring public broadband to our community. And we, like, aligned that with the IMC's work and did free work and, you know, we complemented each other. So I would encourage us to think about, like, what are those cottage industries and, like, kind of keep them autonomous from the spaces that everything has to take a million hours of meetings and it has to be by consensus.
Yeah, it's so tricky because we had this, you know, we all saw this contradiction between we want everyone to be able to be the media and then we want to... which means if you pay a few people, then you're reproducing a small cadre of people making the media. But if you don't pay people, then only people from positions of privilege mm-hmm. have the other resources to do it mm-hmm. and sustain themselves. And so, like, I think mostly indie media, like, one of the crises of indie media was a failure to find a way out of this contradiction. And so what happened is people spun off into tech co-ops and into for-profit companies, into Democracy Now!, into radio stations, all these other ways in which we spun people off. And we never addressed the livelihood problem because we couldn't figure out how to balance this sort of participatory ideology with the need for livelihood. And there are a bunch of co-ops. There's a, you know, I mentioned before, Inspiral is a network in New Zealand that said we can't do social change without addressing the fact of our livelihood because we can't actually be inclusive of people and we're just going to sort of hide the fact that different people come with privilege and we're actually reinforcing that privilege by not paying anyone. Right. And so, like, I think that, like, one of the things we never solved well with indie media is that since indie media's heyday, we have things like crowdfunding, you have things like Patreon, you have things like GoFundMe. And so we're starting to get a little bit of a model for how sort of citizen media can be funded directly by the audience in a way that, you know, very similar to the way a community radio would do a fundraising drive, but for an individual or a collective. And I think today, what we need to do is figure out how to make that work with the balance of funding some collective things. So, you know, how do we make it so that you can get a sustainable model that isn't advertising and people can create stuff?
Yeah, I mean, even in the mainstream world today, there's very few paid journalist jobs. It's a,
right. Yeah.
It's a hard thing to fund in general.
Employment is becoming precarious.
Yeah.
There was a hint in the back, and I feel like we never got to you in the very back. Was it, no?
Me?
Yeah, didn't you have your hand up?
I did have my hand up.
Okay, I'm sorry, I felt like we were not.
All right. Well, I guess I live in the Bay Area, so it's like the outscape of displacement and gentrification, rising rents. I guess I wanted to, like, address this issue of space. And we have a bunch of spaces, actually. Some of them are even owned. Some of them are, like, long-term rental spaces. And despite that, you know, people are being displaced. So suddenly you have these spaces, but
Yeah. Or internalizing capitalism inside all of our media activism
right,
work.
Fundamental contradiction of how do we control without owning in a system that doesn't recognize a lack of ownership. Because as soon as you don't own something, someone else can take it, right? So it's like the fundamental contradiction. You make something, a piece of artwork, and you don't copyright it, and like all of a sudden it can be owned tomorrow. Like, who is I talking to? Freecycle? You're telling me the story about, yeah, about Freecycle. So I think that's the contradiction we're in. Is like, how then can we control without owning? I mean, I think it's a really interesting problem to discuss. Is a land trust where, it's kind of like we set up guidelines for the use of that land that are communally produced, but no one owns it? Like, is that the right direction? I'm very curious about this because I do know that there's a real empire building mentality that can come with purchasing and growing. And people can oftentimes grow to the point where we've had this at our IMC. There have been times when I felt like I had a new baby and the baby was a fucking building. It's like, I do not want to have a building as a baby. Like, I'm so sick of this. I stopped making art a long time ago because it's like running around plugging toilets. And like, I was on the roof, like patching the roof the other day, like literally physically patching the roof. Like, I'm too old to be doing that. But, my partner hauled my ass up there because she's like, I'm not doing this alone. We're doing it together. I'm like, okay, I want this relationship to last, so I'm following you up on the roof, And so it's like definitely times when it's like, do we really want to be doing this with property? And then there are those other times where the city tried to shut us down this year where it's like, oh, my God, I'm so glad we own this space because we have control. That's what we want. We want community control over the space. And the ownership right now in the current system is like, one of the only routes to that, but that's a really good point, and I think there are pitfalls to that ownership mentality.
There are, but I would argue that it's worth it, because, when we started Mayday Space and Star Bar, it consumed my life for 6 years, but it was worth it. So I had a kid for 6 years, and now it's there, and if we had owned that, yes, there's maintenance to do, and some, it probably changed hands a few times, but the amount of work it took to get it started and to get buy-in from the community, that is way more work than just maintaining a building and for future generations to come. I think it's well worth that annoying work of unclogging toilets.
Yeah. Just an attempt to put this in a larger context. Indonesia, in a sense, goes from a hierarchy.